This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris Perry, in for Tanzina Vega. And can I just take a moment to celebrate?
Yes! All right! Yeah. Love
it. Yeah. These days, I'm feeling downright hopeful. This weekend, I went to the grocery store. I mean to the actual store. Inside of it. For Memorial Day, my fully vaccinated family came together. We sat on the porch, ate barbecue, and at the end of the evening, we hugged each other. Aww. It was exactly the sort of normalcy President Joe Biden mentioned in his speech at the White House on Wednesday.
The more people we get vaccinated, the more success we're going to have in our fight against this virus.
Now, the speech is part of the administration's effort to increase vaccination enthusiasm and hit the target of 70% of American adults with at least one dose of vaccine by the 4th of July.
A summer of freedom, a summer of joy, a summer of get-togethers and celebrations, an all-American summer that this country deserves after a long, long dark winter that we've all endured.
On Tuesday, the White House invited community groups to join a Vaccination Month of Action. The president is touting public-private partnerships, offering incentives like event tickets and cash prizes. And in West Virginia, residents can even win guns for getting vaccinated. Yup, bear arms can help you bear arms. But no incentive is more powerful than the vision of
a summer of freedom.
And the vaccination push is urgent. Because as good as it feels to begin gathering again, our national journey through the COVID crisis is not at an end.
This is Ken from Pittsburgh. My employer of 42 years caught COVID 3 weeks ago, about 1 or 2 days before he got his second shot. He had no symptoms for 1 week. He had symptoms that got progressively worse for a week, and then he went into the hospital. The next day, the ICU, the next day after that, on a ventilator. 10 days later, he had pneumonia. 2 days after that, he passed away. We all wear our masks at this store, even now, and we've all been vaccinated twice. We continue to make the customers wear masks, too, and that will happen until 250 million Americans are vaccinated.
According to the New York Times tracker, 519 people died of the coronavirus on Monday. And each day we inch closer to 600,000 lost lives in this country. Globally, the pandemic continues to ravage South America and batter parts of Africa and Asia, including Japan, where athletes from all over the world have already begun to arrive for the Olympic Games. Athletes who will live and mingle and compete for weeks and then return home to nations throughout the world. And here in the U.S., who is continuing to shoulder the burden of the pandemic even as the national picture improves? Well, it looks a lot like it did early on. In the city of Washington, D.C., it's overwhelmingly falling on Black residents. They make up around 80% of current COVID cases, despite being just 46% of the overall population. And according to the Washington Post, states including Kentucky and Tennessee are starting to see similar racial disparities among current infections. And for more on this, I'm now joined by Dr. Deborah Furholden, who is Associate Dean for Public Health Integration and Director of the Flint Center for Health Equity Solutions at Michigan State University. Dr. Furholden, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me. This is a great conversation.
And also with us is S. Mitra Kalita, publisher of Epicenter, a newsletter for New Yorkers to get through the pandemic. She's also CEO of URL Media, a network of Black and Brown community news outlets. Mitra, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks. It's a great to be here.
Deborah, I want to start with you. In mid-May, you told the news outlet Bridge Michigan that, quote, the virus is still wreaking havoc in the community. Is that still the case today for Black and Brown residents of Michigan?
The numbers have gotten slightly better in Michigan. We were in the height of a surge at that point. But we still have tremendous racial disparities that exist in COVID deaths In some communities, we have disparities in COVID cases. And more importantly, we have tremendous disparities in who's actually getting the shots in the arms. So I keep telling people, we're just not out of the woods yet. You know, this is not the time to take our foot off the gas. This is the time to stay the course. So it's better, but we still are dealing with real problems with getting this pandemic under control.
Mitra, how about you, based here in Queens, New York? How significant do the racial disparities look to you?
They feel fairly significant, and unfortunately, that has been the story throughout the vaccine rollout. So I would agree with Dr. Folden that it's looking better, but at least here in Queens, the least vaccinated group remain Black residents of Queens. I believe only 21% of them have gotten one dose, and you can compare that to the rest of New York City, which is well over half have received one dose. And so that is a hill to climb, right? And there's a number of reasons for that. But, I do feel like there are some lessons we've seen and learned in January, and we're already in June, and I still feel like they're not quite getting through on the vaccine rollout.
Okay, so let's pause right there, because that's where I want to dig in. When we look at a disparity, right, at an inequity in a number, that's just sort of a fact or a data point. But it's really the meaning behind it, the causes that that are the public health question, right? The what do we do about it? So, Dr. Verhulden, let me come to you on that. If we're looking at disparate rates of infection and disparate rates of vaccination, is that because of personal behavior? Is that because of vaccine reluctance? Is it an access question? What is going on?
So earlier in the pandemic, we pointed to the same old usual suspects. We said, oh, African Americans have more pre-existing health conditions, and they were sicker going into the pandemic, and that's why they're doing worse with these COVID-related illnesses. And it turns out that just wasn't the case. In fact, many of the factors that were driving both the increased likelihood for Black and brown people of becoming cases and also dying if they contracted COVID were things that were outside of their control. That shelter in place order, the stay home, the ability to switch your work over to, you know, some online platform where you could do it from your living room. A lot of people simply didn't have that luxury. The gap in the inequality that we see in wages and employment and then the types of occupations that people hold, that showed up in the pandemic. And we found out that a lot of the excess exposure that we saw in Black and brown and other underserved communities was not related anything to the actions or behaviors or the will of the individual. In fact, it was related to these larger macro social and political determinants of health. The fact that Black and brown people are overrepresented in high demand, low wage jobs. Those physicians weren't providing PPE and basics like face masks and paid time off for people. And we're seeing the exact same thing happening with vaccinations. I know so many people who've said, I'd be willing to get the vaccine, but could I get a paid day off? My colleagues who got the vaccine got sick. And I don't want to care for patients, or I don't want to have to deliver food, or I don't want to have to stand at the checkout line checking people out if I'm sick, if I have a fever, or if I'm not feeling well. So we're just lacking a lot of a real truth telling about some of these larger societal factors that really make our world quite inequitable and unfair for people based on things like race, where you live, how much money you make, in those types of factors. So we learned that early in the pandemic, and we have to do a better job of bringing those lessons forward in this vaccine rollout strategy.
I so appreciate that point. Even as we were kind of thinking about the intro, I was like, I really was hyped to go to the grocery store. But I also acknowledge, right, the very real privilege associated with the fact that I not only haven't had to go to the grocery store, I haven't had to work in the grocery store, which is, of course, the reality for so many Black and brown communities, right? It's not just can you go, it's that is your job, and you are in this close contact with folks at every point. Mitra, I want to talk to you a little bit about that vaccine access question as well. again, if we go to Dr. Verholden's point about kind of the old narratives that showed up, like, oh, well, you know, Black folks aren't going to get the vaccine because Tuskegee. I mean, I don't want to argue that that isn't some part of it, but what are you hearing about access relative to vaccines?
So I don't think we have to go as far back as Tuskegee to understand the mistrust in the system. And, you know, it is a present day reality for Black and brown people. That can mean, you know, somebody saying they have symptoms of COVID and not being treated seriously by their doctor. It might mean an issue of documentation or access, right? So I think it's just important to understand the factors that create mistrust and friction in the system and actually don't even allow a large portion of our population to interact with the healthcare system. So that was, you know, I've been a journalist for more than two decades, and I felt somewhat naive because Epicenter, our organization, started helping people get booked for the vaccines. And if you think about a lot of the narratives we just take for granted, it's like, oh, if you have allergies or if you're pregnant or if you have this condition, ask your doctor. Well, many of our people don't even have a doctor, right?
So I was like, that's assuming you have one, that's right?
There's so many assumptions, but like, think about even, you know, Dr. Verholden's point on the conditions under which we're working. Terms like social distancing and quarantine, which, you know, my assumption, again, all of us on this call are, you know, those are terms that we get. And they're terms, at least here in the Epicenter, which is the neighborhoods of Jackson Heights, Corona, Elmhurst, and Queens, that were so hard hit by COVID. For many people in their apartments, it's absolutely impossible to social distance. And so if you get COVID, if the CDC puts out guidance saying, you know, you can unmask now, you know, you got to look around in some of these blended households and say, well, some of us have our vaccines. Some of us work in grocery stores. You know, some of us don't, you know, share one bedroom, multiple people. Like, is this one size fits all, no mask policy going to work for our communities? And I think the answer is no.
So, Dr. Verholden, let me come to you on this. On Wednesday, President Biden announced some initiatives to get more people vaccinated this month, including a partnership with Black barbershops. That, along with what you were talking about in terms of potentially a day off. It's funny. It sounds to me an awful lot, like what it also takes to get people to vote, right? That you need a little bit of room, a little bit of access, some information from trusted sources.
I cannot underscore enough during this time the value of the trusted, credible messenger. Most people are getting their information from social media, from news media, and word of mouth. And so for the people who are those trusted, credible messengers in community, they are already doing the work. Barbers and friends and family and the local federally qualified health centers and local trusted leaders are already doing all that they can to boost COVID literacy and boost vaccine confidence in communities. I love this approach of better resourcing those partners, those trusted messengers who have more credibility with the people who are on the fence than somebody like myself or even a national spokesperson could ever have. So we do need to have more grassroots, ground up efforts and resource communities to do that work.
Mitra, I want to talk to you a little bit about another form of access here, and that has to do with where one can get a vaccine. Talk to me about the subway stations.
So I think one of the best things, this is good news on the government's part, a few weeks ago, they really started to make a push to not just have vaccine megasites as the place to get your vaccine, but really push into communities through mobile vans and even the New York City subway system. It's been wildly popular because, to the points we've been making of people who are working, you know, two, maybe three jobs, they might not have time to get to a vaccine clinic or their doctor's office or a mega site. But if they're commuting, the vaccine's offered in the, you know, in the subway system. And sure enough, You know, that has been a wildly successful program. Similarly, here in Jackson Heights, there have been these mobile units in popular business districts and where restaurant workers gather. And those, you know, as soon as they brought the vaccines into neighborhoods, you saw an uptick and you saw, you know, and it wasn't really rocket science. It was, of course, you got to decentralize, you know, to the doctor's point, you got to decentralize and get the shots to the places where people are, but also delivered and information given by people whom they trust.
There's another set of lessons that I feel like we've learned in public health when there are these kinds of racial health disparities over time. And one is that once it gets kind of stuck, if you end up with high levels of vaccination and COVID kind of goes away for folks with resources and for predominantly white communities, sometimes we can lose political incentive to address infectious disease once it is perceived and experienced as a Black and brown disease. Dr. Verholden, is that possible with COVID?
It is. And I think what it underscores is we've learned a lot during COVID. I always say COVID didn't create these problems. What it did is it shined a light, and it gave us an opportunity to have a real honest reckoning with the truth about how unfair and inequitable our society really is. And there's a real business case to be made for equity. This pandemic will have cost us more than $2 trillion to resolve. And that's if things continue on the path that they're on and we actually come out on the other side before the end of the year. You know, there's a real cost to inequity in our society. There's a cost to human capital and the loss of life. There's a real financial cost. And I think the problem is that by design, our society didn't have equity baked in. Our society was built and constructed without equity baked into it. So now the question is, how do we do that? How do we have it be that what we learned in COVID doesn't end in COVID, but rather we start to re-envision and reimagine and re-engineer our society and our healthcare system so that equity is now baked into it? And I do think that we can do that. And it's going to require a few things. It's going to require legislative action. It's going to require enforcement. And we need real incentives for equity and disincentives for inequity.
Early on, I know our family was sustaining so many losses, especially with our family in New Orleans, but it did feel as though we were all in it together. But for friends and family members who are now beginning to lose folks, even as we're coming out of it, they seem to be feeling much more isolated in that experience of illness and loss. Have you been hearing from people on this? And what are the resources for providing some support?
I think the United States is in this really privileged position where we don't have a vaccine shortage. We are so blessed that there are no issues of supply in this country. And so what I would say is that, to your point of being in it together, you know, we started out the pandemic with that sensibility, and now we're starting to see somewhat of a fracture between who, even in the U.S., you know, if this is going to be a Black and brown disease, are we going to prioritize it in the same way that we do other illnesses, as well as the seriousness with which we treated COVID a year ago? And I also think it's important to continue the sentiment of being one world, that our brothers and sisters in Brazil and India and Peru and some of the places that you've mentioned don't have access to vaccine, but we are a connected world. And so between some of the conditions that are more dense in terms of housing and the jobs that we've talked about today, the reality of who is not getting vaccinated or access to vaccines in the U.S., and then these very scary variants of potentially from overseas or people migrating to and fro, you know, we know that we are one world, and I really do hope that we act that way in order to get to the other side.
S. Mitra Kalita is the publisher of the newsletter Epicenter and CEO of URL Media. And Dr. Deborah Verholden is the director of the Flint Center for Health Equity Solutions at Michigan State University. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for bringing this conversation forward.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to be here.
Last week, President Biden urged intelligence officials to continue investigating the origins of COVID-19. And this investigation is receiving support.
We feel strongly, all of us, that we should continue with the investigation and go to the next phase of the investigation that the WHO has done. So because we don't know 100% what the origin is, it's imperative that we look and we do an investigation.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And although it was originally thought that COVID-19 came from a wet market in Wuhan, China, where it was transmitted from animals to humans, now researchers are looking at whether the virus came from a lab, even though the World Health Organization released a report this year rejecting just that theory. There's now a growing chorus of scientists calling for a deeper look into the origins. Here to help us understand this is Daniel Einberg, who is senior editor at The Atlantic. Daniel, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
So help us to understand what the lab leak theory is.
So the lab leak theory is kind of a catch-all at this point. It includes the idea that the SARS-CoV-2 virus was deliberately engineered and as a bioweapon and possibly deliberately released. So that's one extreme end of what has sometimes been called the lab leak hypothesis. And then the other end would be something more like this was a virus that was gathered in bat guano samples, brought to a lab, and accidentally made its way out one way or another. So there's a full range of possibilities here. All those are kind of lumped together under the umbrella term lab leak.
Well, so that's really helpful. It doesn't necessarily mean that there were sort of evil scientists creating COVID-19, although that seems to be one possibility. It could also be that simply they were using it in the lab for some set of purposes and it accidentally leaked.
Right. Yeah, I guess the one way to think about it is there's a continuum from sloppy science to evil science. All would be consistent with the lab leak hypothesis.
Actually, that's extremely helpful as a way to think about it. Now, obviously, we'd heard about this, previously from President Trump. It had been sort of critical to his public discourse around the origins of COVID-19. And again, even the WHO releasing reports saying that that's not what happened. So why are we now thinking about it?
I mean, just one thing about the WHO, there was an investigation coordinated through the WHO that concluded that the lab leak hypothesis was very unlikely and among the least likely possible explanations for the source of COVID. But the WHO director general questioned that finding and pointed out himself that not much work was done to investigate the possibility. So I don't know if it's fair to say that the WHO as a whole has rejected this idea. But that was one of the major events. I bring it up because that statement from the director general was one of the events recently that has led to, I think, a reappraisal of the probabilities. It's not as though tons of new evidence has just emerged to make the lab leak hypothesis seem more likely, but some pretty prominent voices have come out and said, look, we just haven't really investigated this fully. Maybe we can't make those kinds of statements that it's extremely unlikely or, you know, the odds are vanishingly small. We just don't know.
So that idea of we just don't know, it feels to me is actually at the core of scientific inquiry in terms of what science is meant to do, to go back, to reappraise a hypothesis. So talk to me about why it matters. What difference does it make if it came from a lab?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Some people have said, oh, it makes no difference whatsoever. You know, we have to deal with the pandemic we have, and it started some way, so let's end it. Certainly, it's true. That's the primary goal right now. But the argument for studying the origins is that, you know, in order to prevent the next pandemic, it would really help to know what caused this one. I think that's, you know, clearly true to some extent. Pandemics happen very rarely, thankfully. So you want to know what causes them, and that helps focus efforts to prevent them. On the other hand, my feeling is the mere fact that a lab leak scenario is possible, and I mean possible in the sense of, you know, there's some reasonable likelihood, it's not just, you know, a one in a billion possibility, suggest that we should take that very seriously, whatever the origins of COVID. And obviously, we know from past experience that spillover from wildlife is a source of pandemics, as it has been in the past.
So this question of its origins and this language you just gave us about whether or not there is some sort of reasonable possibility, again, all of that feels to be consistent with what science does. You come to one conclusion, you get a little bit more evidence, you think about it differently, you investigate in a different way. Is this consistent with how, you know, we've studied the origins of other kinds of things that affect human health? Or are we looking at something that feels more politicized or potentially conspiratorial?
Right. Well, the inherent uncertainty in science often becomes a political tool. There's a long history of that. And I think this is an interesting case because often that uncertainty and that kind of question asking for political purposes serves as a way of doing nothing, you know, a way of heading off regulation. That's the familiar story with big tobacco or various environmental regulations or other safety regulations. You know, you'll just say, well, do we really know for sure that smoking causes cancer? And until we know for sure, should we really do anything drastic about curtailing smoking rates? This is kind of an opposite situation, as far as I can tell, where the issue is there going to be more action to prevent the risk of laboratory accidents in the future? Is there going to be more government regulation of this sort of research? You know, there's good arguments to be had about the pros and cons of doing that kind of thing. But I do think right here, the asking questions tendency is meant to prod further action, which makes it different from that kind of weaponized doubt or, you know, doubt mongering that we've seen in the past of this kind.
So you talk about asking questions, which leads to investigation. What does an investigation entail or look like?
Well, right now, it seems like there aren't a lot of good ways that this will unfold just because of the political implications and the diplomatic strains here. But it would be nice, for example, to, if you really wanted to rule out a lab leak hypothesis or investigate it more fully, to look more closely at the records at the Wuhan Institute of Virology or other labs in the area. There's still some, you know, uncertainty around some of the original cases. You know, China identified quite a number of cases of pneumonia-like illness in November and December. A lot of those were, you know, ruled out, although it's not exactly clear. The WHO investigation team didn't have access to all of the medical data and explanations for why all of those cases were ruled out. So there's just a lot of, you know, a lot of stones left unturned that would help fill out the picture.
I so appreciate this opportunity to talk with you. And I really appreciate the language of weaponized doubt versus genuine curiosity for the public good. Daniel Engber is the senior editor at The Atlantic. Daniel, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tenzina Vega. After 50 years of growth, American higher ed shed more than 500,000 workers last year as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. Pivoting to online courses meant colleges and universities sent away students and billions in residential housing and campus fees. Most consequential for the institutional bottom line? International students. Recent reporting in Politico found that national border closures, visa restrictions, and persistent uncertainty forced international students to leave campus and dissuaded new students from applying. And because international students regularly pay full tuition and fees, losing these students was devastating for collegiate revenue. With international students forced off campus, higher ed workers were forced out of jobs. And with the fall semester just a few months away, some universities and their international students are still uncertain about what the future holds. Joining me now is Shin Wong, Associate Professor of China Studies and Division Director of African and Asian Languages at Baylor University. Hi, Shin. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Lovely to have you with us today. And Lorraine Janota, who is Senior Digital Producer and Morning Education Writer at Politico. So nice to have you, Lorraine.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start with you, Lorraine. Talk to me about what you found in your reporting at Politico when it comes to what happens to what happened to colleges and universities since the start of the pandemic.
Yeah, so since the start of the pandemic, they've really suffered financially just because a lot of students, international students, haven't been able to come here because of either travel bans or just fears of the coronavirus, or financially for them also, for students, they aren't able to come here. So as a result, colleges and universities aren't getting the students who are pretty much giving them the most money. So they've really suffered financially because of that.
So Lorraine, I so appreciate that. And I feel like for many folks who aren't in higher ed, this was a surprising new thing to learn about how higher ed revenue production works. And so Shin, I wanted to come to you on this. When is it that American higher ed became so heavily dependent on the tuition and fees of international students?
I think particularly in the last 20 years, and when you look at the data, especially from Open Doors, and you can see how students, how international student enrollment has been increasing in double digits in last 20 years. And I think especially after financial crisis, when a lot of universities are really kind of relying on tuition-driven revenues from international students, and particularly for students from China, because they are about a third of the international student enrollment in the United States. And we're talking about students from China generating about $16 billion a year. So that's a really important for a lot of universities, especially I think for large public universities, when international student enrollment is about 8 to 10% of their total enrollment.
So I think that that distinction between various kinds of universities is so critical, right? This notion of tuition dependence, in part being at these large state universities, states where often we've seen university revenue cut by state legislatures, basically, right? And so that need for tuition dependence rising. Lorraine, I'm wondering if, because I'm thinking those are also the universities, particularly in the South, where we saw massive outbreaks of COVID-19 infections, especially in the fall when students first arrived back on campus. I'm wondering that is going to deter international students from wanting to apply to American universities.
I haven't seen anything that says that students aren't wanting to come here anymore because of the coronavirus specifically. If they weren't coming here, it might be just because they don't feel like it was welcoming, especially in the previous administration. But Biden administration has been a bit more welcoming in their communication about international students.
Can you say just a little bit more about that feeling that international students may have about the sense that they're not welcome in the United States or at American colleges and universities?
The last administration had rules that weren't very welcoming toward international students. So they had travel bans just because of the coronavirus. So they weren't allowing students from certain countries to come. Also, the way that the president talked about certain countries, especially China, kind of hostile language about other countries. I think there were surveys that showed that international students didn't feel like the U.S. was very welcoming. So a lot of them were looking elsewhere to study that was more welcoming, like Canada, for example. That's what I saw in some of the surveys that I've looked at and some of the people that I talked to.
And Shin, clearly we know that there's been a massive uptick in anti-Asian violence and also hate crimes, you know, even if they're expressed verbally, even if they're not expressed physically. So I'm wondering if families, as they're, you know, making decisions about where they're going to send their young people to school, are nervous in the ways that Lorraine has described here.
I think that's a great question. I think that's exactly right about the concerns from the parents and concerns of students from China. And just very recently, I had a very close friend and who lived in China, and their daughter applied a number of universities in the United States. And they have always been thinking about the United States as the destination for their daughter's higher education. But at very last minute, they also applied for University of Toronto, and then they finally decided they're going to give up their, you know, their dream for sending their daughter to the United States. Instead, they're sending their daughter to University of Toronto because they feel the anti-Asian rhetoric and also attacks, either verbal or physical, and that increasing anti-Asian rhetoric and racism in the United States has affected their decision. And they're very concerned about the safety and security of their, you know, of their daughter being in the United States. And let's also talk about that deteriorating U.S.-China relations in the last several years have also kind of worried them. So they, when they're facing this kind of political uncertainty and social unrest, and they decided United States is not the best place at this moment for their daughter to pursue her post-secondary education. So that's actually very right among many, you know, many parents. And that was not a concern before, but, you know, in the last couple of years, I think that becomes very concerning for them.
So, Lorraine, one of the things that we know is that students who were taking most of their classes online were not eligible for the visa status that they previously had when taking classes in the classroom. Is the Biden administration working to open borders more clearly for international students?
Yes. So the Biden administration actually eased the Trump-era travel bans that didn't allow students to get student visas if their classes will be online. So Biden will allow students on visas to study online if their campuses close because of COVID-19 outbreaks. But other than that, I think the other thing that the Biden administration has done is that they also put certain countries in the national interest exception list for the travel ban. So what happened was that now students from certain areas like China, parts of the European Union, I think Iran also, students from there can travel to the U.S. to get a student visa here and to study here. So that was, even if their countries are part of the COVID-19 travel bans.
Shin, I'm wondering about what the long-term consequences of this moment might be, that rather than simply thinking about sort of revenue bottom line, if maybe it also reveals a kind of fissure, a fracture that American universities may have been extracting more from our international students, and particularly our Chinese students, than we've been returning. And if in order to get Chinese students again to think of American universities as you know, the international universities of choice, that American higher ed may have to make some changes in our interactions, either with China as a nation or with the students and families?
That's a great question. I think American universities have always been regarded as one of the best higher education systems in the whole world. And that's probably one of the things that Chinese parents and Chinese students and the society really want to send their children, the students, to United States to study, pursue the best of education. But I think and another reason I think is really the college experience that they have when they're having their children here, because they do believe that educational experience is probably more important than just the piece of paper, the credential that received by the end of their education. So as American universities and higher education institutions, we need to start thinking about how can we emphasize the campus experience more, you know, for our international students. And we need to provide services to our students because they really can build the cross-cultural dialogue and cross-cultural understanding with our American students. And we need to think about some kind of innovative ways of integrating our international students in our classrooms and in political science classes, in business classes, in many different classes. We need to start thinking about how can we build intentionally that kind of cross-cultural understanding and dialogue. And sometimes we also need to have that kind of cultural sensitivity when dealing with international students on our campuses, helping them adjust them, helping them adjust socially, culturally to a new living environment, new academic environment, and helping them improve their language and helping them understand American society and Western culture, because that's actually their motivation to come to the United States to study.
I so appreciate those insights. I have seen on far too many campuses the ways that, again, particularly Chinese students end up sort of in a separated kind of social circle, having one kind of experience that is entirely separate from the experience of both domestic U.S. students and other international students. And it always seems to me like such an extraordinarily lost opportunity, and that even as we're talking about the financial crisis aspect here, there is this opportunity for rethinking American higher ed more broadly. Lorraine, let me just ask this. Can you talk to me about the logistics of what happens when someone is, in fact, admitted to a U.S.-based university? What do they then have to do? And is that going to be, again, in any ways, either streamlined or changed going forward into the fall?
Yeah. So when a student gets accepted to the university, the next step is deciding whether they want to accept or deny or either defer. So for that, students are, I think that's where the concern is, because especially for the story that Bianca and I did for Politico, we focused on Indian international students, and right now consulates in India are closed. So even if they do accept an admission to a U.S. university, they might not be able to get a visa on time for the fall semester. So they're not sure if they should accept it and then just hope that the visa will come through, or if they should defer for the spring semester and know for sure that they'll get the visa on time. So because consulates are closed, it's really hard for anyone really to figure out if what the enrollment will be like in the fall, because that's really an important part of this process, is getting that visa. And that what's hindering that is that visas you need to have in-person interviews, so that's not something that they can just do over Zoom because of security reasons. So that, there are some higher education institutions that are pushing for the Biden administration to kind of ease those rules, just so that we can get these visas processed quickly and so we can get students in the U.S. In the fall semester.
Lorraine Genota is a senior digital producer and morning education writer at Politico, and Shin Wong is an associate professor of China Studies and division director of African and Asian languages at Baylor University. Thank you both for taking the time today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Okay, guys, that's the show. I hope you enjoyed today's show as much as I did. And remember, if you missed anything from today or you want to listen back again, check out our podcast. You can find it wherever you get your pods, or you can head on over to thetakeaway.org. And of course, keep calling us with your ideas and thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.